Our second case for the morning, Regency West v. City of Racine. Are you all ready to proceed? Please do so.
May it please the court, Maureen McGinnity of Foley and Lardner appearing for the petitioner, Regency West Apartments, LLC. We're here today because the Racine assessors used the wrong methodology and violated Wisconsin law in assessing the petitioner's IRC Section 42 low-income tax credit property for the years 2012 and 13. The property at issue is not a garden variety commercial property, but the assessors erroneously treated it as though it were. Specifically, the assessors used the comparable sales approach for the 2013 assessment, which the Wisconsin Property Assessor's Manual recognizes is not a reliable approach to assess properties like plaintiffs. And for 2012, they used the correct methodology, the income approach, but their implementation of that approach violated Wisconsin law and the manual specific to low-income housing developments. The result was to grossly overassess plaintiff's property and threaten its economic viability. The assessments came up over $4 million for both years. Application of the correct methodology results in proper assessments of about $2.7 million.
But when you say that,
pardon me?
When you say that, and first I want to give you credit without prejudicing my decision one way or the other, I at least want to give you credit for one of the most depressing phrases I've ever read in a brief in a property description context, which is the subject property is located on 7 acres just near the abandoned Sam's Club on one side and the county dump on the other.
That's actually correct, Your Honor.
I want to say I recognize the effort that must have gone into polishing it.
Location, location, location.
Was that dump the landfill?
Yes, sir.
After it's a landfill, you make it a golf course or something. Build on it, right?
Not our property, but...
too bad there wasn't a toxic river flowing nearby. In all seriousness, you talk about the methodology.
Yes.
Why isn't it for 2012, it's a new property. Now, granted, they were full up. You were full up.
Yes.
In February. And obviously, there's no Tier 1.
Correct.
So it seems to me they're going to go to Tier 2 and look around for comparables. But you're going to say, you would say to that, the comparables just aren't present for that. It has to be, it should have been expense, or it should be expense.
Well, 2 points on that, Justice Gableman.
And then the third, as long as you're going to go on a roll, I want to add the 2013 in there. Why would it have been improper for them to have used the Tier 3 analysis on the 2013 as part of the Tier 2? And for them to say, well, look, if we were wrong on the Tier 2 for 2013, we got the right answer on the Tier 3. So
okay.
That just goes to, you brought up methodology, and it was the wrong methodology, and so that's the context I'm asking.
Correct. First of all, the assessors did not use comparable sales for 2012.
Correct.
They only used the income approach. They didn't purport to use the comparable sales approach at all until 2013. And the reason that it's improper to use the comparable sales approach has to do with the fact that this is a U.S. Treasury Section 42 low-income housing development.
Yes.
This property is subject to special rules,
sure.
Assessment rules, as recognized in the assessment manual. And what it has to do with, Your Honor, is the requirement under both the property assessor's manual and case law that in order to use the comparable sales approach, there must be reasonably comparable properties. In the manual, the most important characteristic of reasonable comparability that the manual requires for these kinds of properties is similar restrictions. What that means in this instance is that you would have to find properties that have, at a minimum, that are Section 42 tax credit properties. The three properties
but
that the...
Is that necessarily true? And I don't want you, I don't want to get you too far off the line you're going on, because you're going in a pretty straight line. I'm not confident that's true, because it seems to me that when it comes to working out the details of the contracts in both Section 42 and Section 8, that a lot is up to the respective leverage between the developer and the original owner, whoever bargains first with the government, that within the relatively strict parameters, there is room to maneuver on the part of the federal government. So I don't know that it's fair to say that, okay, one Section 42 housing development equals another, just any other generic Section 42 housing, because those, if say they're two owners, owner A might have negotiated different terms than owner B.
I completely agree with you, Your Honor. What I am saying is, at a minimum, you would have to start with two properties that are subject to the same regulatory scheme. Here, we didn't even have that. The properties that the assessors used as comparables were not other Section 42 properties.
Ms. McGinnity, is it possible to make adjustments for the differing limitations between Section 42 and Section 8 properties?
No.
Why not?
They are completely, two reasons. Number one, the manual requires for that assessors, if they're going to try to use the comparable sales approach, they have to actually obtain the regulatory agreements so that they are familiar with the specific restrictions that are applicable to both the subject property and the comparison properties. Here it is undisputed that the assessors didn't even have the agreements. They didn't look at the agreement applicable to the subject property, and they didn't look at the agreements applicable to the comparison property.
In 2013, though, didn't they talk to the owners?
No.
They received information somehow about...
They did not have the agreements, Your Honor. That is of record.
I know they didn't have the agreements, but how did... They did get information.
They had income and expense information, but what the manual requires... keep in mind, your question is, can you use the comparable sales approach? So we're on that approach now, not the income approach.
We got to be careful which year we're talking about.
Yes.
I'm trying to keep these. So please, which year are you talking about?
I'm talking about the propriety of the comparable sales approach, which I thought was your question. So
okay.
For purposes of these facts, we're talking about 2013.
Yes.
So you would have to have the agreements to be able to look at the specific restrictions. The assessors didn't obtain the agreements, so they could not possibly have fulfilled their obligation to determine that there were similar restrictions. So that's point one.
So if I'm understanding correctly, then you're saying two things. One, there is no possibility of making sufficient adjustments between Section 42 and Section 8 properties, and even if there was, they weren't aware of those restrictions, and so they couldn't have accounted for.
That's correct. And the second point, Justice Kelly, is that Section 8 and Section 42 are completely different federal programs. There's no way to adjust for the fact that Section 42 is a tax credit program. The way that works is that the developers get a tax credit over a period of 10 years, and they then that then allows them to reduce construction debt, which then allows them to offer lower rents. Okay, that's point one. The Section 8 is a much more desirable program. That's a true rent subsidy program. So the owners of those developments, the tenants only have to pay up to 30% of their income towards the rent, and the government picks up the rest of the tab. So you can imagine the low risk that owners of those developments have. As a consequence, there is a very rampant market available for sales of Section 8. The fact of the matter is that program's not available anymore, which is now it's been substituted for Section 42.
So
they operate in completely different markets.
Sure. Does the Wisconsin Manual for Assessing Properties speak to the difference between Section 42 and Section 8 properties?
Yes. In our exhibit, Trial Exhibit 34, there is a special section that the Property Assessment Manual has on assessing what they collectively refer to as subsidized housing. And that section discusses 10 different federal programs. And it stresses that those programs fall into four basic categories. Some are, like our client's property, have the income tax credit. Then there's, like the Section 8, where there are true rent subsidies. Then there are some where there's a mortgage insurance, and then there are others that have mortgage interest rate.
You're doing a wonderful job of outlining the general differences, and you're doing a wonderful job of outlining the general differences, but I think at the trial, my recollection is there was testimony from the city's assessors in regard to the actual income streams of Regency West and the Section 8 housing. They used, I think my recollection is they used two Section 8 housing and one property that was half Section 42 and half regular.
Not half and half. Predominantly market with a few Section 42 units.
Okay, well, in any event.
Yes.
I really want to talk about the nitty-gritty because I think that's where this is,
sure.
Not the general, because otherwise we don't need you. We could just open the book and we could look to see the differences. There was testimony here about the income streams of the property. There was the city's witnesses, my recollection is, offered the opinion that the investment risk at Regency West cannot have been higher than Section 8 risk because Regency West had very low vacancy in 2012. They were filled up. My recollection is they opened in January. They were filled in February.
That is not the test of reasonable comparability.
Oh, I know, but this is the testimony. This is the testimony, though.
Right,
of
I understand.
Comparables. We're talking comparables, though.
Right, I understand that, Your Honor. But, again, I'm trying to respond to your question as to whether or not the comparable sales approach can be used. The manual says, in order to use the comparable sales approach for subsidized housing, which is an umbrella term used to collect all of these different 10 different federal programs that have very different attributes, in order to use that, they have to have similar restrictions. Doesn't say they have to have similar vacancy rates, they have to have similar incomes.
That all depends on what the definition of restrictions is. I mean, well, one person's restriction would be another person's benefit, I think.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because the manual goes into great detail in describing what the restrictions are, and it doesn't define vacancy rate as a restriction. So I think
they shouldn't look. I mean, if two properties have similar expenses, similar income, that the city just that cannot be used as a comparable.
Absolutely not, because the law requires similar
restrictions.
And as a factual matter, since you raised the point, Your Honor, even though the city's witnesses testified
yes.
that there were similar rents, that's not a relevant consideration, that their own work papers belie that testimony. If you look at Exhibit 61, page 2, that's the city's work papers, it shows that a three-bedroom apartment in a Section 8, that was the Albert House, rents $200 a month higher than a similar three-bedroom in Regency West. There's just no factual support.
Aren't we straying now into the conversation of a subpart of the record on the 2013 assessment, which is the city's argument that says, look, if the Tier 2 analysis was not correct, we did an adequate Tier 3 analysis.
Yes, and I'm happy to talk about the income approach because that is where they made clear legal errors.
I'm not trying to trip you up in your presentation. I'm just trying to ask you the question that I'm
sure.
Clear.
Ms. McGinnity, as,
yes.
you get, as you make that transition from comparable sales to the income approach, I'm wondering if you might be able to incorporate this into your presentation. So your position that comparable sales is an unavailable method
yes.
based on the idea that there are insufficient comparable sales to make that analysis. That's right.
It goes beyond that, Your Honor.
It is because of the differing limitations.
Right. It's a recognition that, you know, the assessors in the lower courts, and I assume this court, are well familiar with the overarching principle in Wisconsin that there's a preference for the comparable sales approach. And God forbid an assessor doesn't use a comp sales approach or an appraiser. So I think that's what's in the back of everybody's mind. But what I am saying is that is not the general rule when you talk about subsidized housing. That's where people got tripped up below. That's where the assessors got tripped up, and that's where the lower courts got tripped up. It's the opposite, that the comparable sales approach would be the exception. Only if the assessor had properties of with similar restrictions, so you'd have to have Section 42s, and then you'd have to have all of the other types of similarity that we discuss in the brief. You'd have to have the same bedroom configurations. You'd have to have the same set asides. You would have to have the agreements to be able to do the comparison.
Yeah. So let's. So what I want to do is tease out what appears to me at least to be a common point between the comparable sales approach and the income approach, and that is this. In a comparable sales, obviously you're looking for properties that are similar in character and nature, and with subsidized housing having similar limitations, and you're finding out what they sell for, you make your adjustments on the chart, and you come to the concluded value. In the income approach, you are still in one piece of the analysis looking for comparable properties because you have to develop a cap rate, right?
Yes, but comparable similar properties. And this is where the manual, the property assessment manual, also is specific when it relates to subsidized housing. Again.
So if there are enough comparable properties to develop a cap rate, why would there not be sufficient comparable properties to develop a sales comparison value?
Because the cap rate is determined from the relationship between income and sales price. That information does not derive from the regulatory agreements. The regulatory agreements are not a matter of public record.
Right, but if the regulatory agreements have an impact on the value of the property because of the limitations that they embody, then when you're developing the cap rate with those properties, the interaction of the elements of developing the cap rate are going to go right back to the value of those limitations and what the value, the depressant effect of those limitations on the value of the property, right?
No. You cannot tell from a cap rate what restrictions apply to the property that was sold. There's no way you can do that. You have to have the agreement. And it still comes back to the fact that we're dealing with completely different programs here.
Okay. And when Mr. McLaughlin developed his report,
yes.
When he developed his cap rate,
yes.
Did he first find out what the limitations were for the properties that he used to develop that cap rate?
He did not have available the agreements. What he did was research sales of other Section 42 properties to get a cap rate so that he could develop a market cap rate based on sales of similar properties, i.e. sales of Section 42 properties.
Yes. So that's that seems to be the nub of the question. If he found sufficient comparable sales to develop the cap rate, then why weren't those comparable sales sufficient to develop a sales comparison?
Because he didn't have the regulatory agreements. And you
right. So, but in the income approach, when he's developing the cap rate, the sale price is a piece of the cap rate. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And the sale price is going to be affected by the types of limitations that are on that property.
Yes, but I think that that's a very different matter from saying that the sale price is affected by the cap or the cap price is affected by it, than saying you can do an adjustment grid to compare the restrictions between two properties when you don't have the underlying agreements. If you look at, for example, what the kinds of restrictions are on this property, you've got WIDA telling my client, for a one-bedroom, you have an income restriction applicable to the tenant. You've got a rent restriction. You've got a utility allowance. Those things all vary depending on the income of the tenant, the location of the property. You would need to know all of those things. So just knowing what the cap rate was of some property that's sold, even if it's a Section 42, that doesn't allow you to compare apples with apples and do a valid comparable sales.
Counselor, I think where the disconnect in your argument is, if I understand Justice
the justice's questions is you use the assertion that the properties used by the city were not similar to the one you have here, so they weren't reasonably comparable.
Correct.
But you use that same language to say they set the cap rate by looking at sales of similar properties. Okay, so you're using the same terminology, and what it sounds like is, well, you can look at the sales, you can find similar properties and do the sales, then how is it there aren't similar properties to do a comparison in regard to determining the value of it based on those sales? So it's the terminology that you're using, I think, that's causing the problem. At
okay.
least that's my take.
And the terminology comes from the manual.
It may, but it's not helping the court to use
okay.
the same purpose.
So for comparable sales, the precondition is that the properties have to have similar restrictions. In order to verify that there are similar restrictions, the assessor has to have the underlying regulatory agreements. Undisputed, the assessor did not have the underlying regulatory agreement, did not look at it for either the subject or the comparables. In my view, end of story, take comparable sales off the ticket right there. Admittedly, did not do what the manual required as a basic verification. But beyond that, as a matter of law, we say Section 8s are not reasonably comparable to Section 42s. When you read the manual, Exhibit 34, and look at the description of what a Section 8 property, what are the Section 8 attributes versus Section 42, completely different. One is a tax credit program, one is a rent subsidy program. They operate in completely different markets.
I think we get the difference. We get the difference, Counselor.
Okay.
The question is, how can you use the same Section 42 properties that you don't know the restrictions on as a comparable sale for determining the cap rate? That's the question.
It's not a comparable sale.
I thought you looked at the sales of Section 42 properties to determine the cap rate that your expert employed.
For cap rate purposes, you're looking at what is the market. So now it's not a comparable sales. It's saying what is the relevant market. The relevant market is sales of Section 42.
Better terminology.
Okay.
Much clearer.
Okay.
Thank you. Much.
I have.
Right. Well, let's. How many properties did Mr. McLaughlin use in developing the cap rate?
His exhibit is 42, and I want to say there were about 10 sales over a period of several years.
Right. So let's, properties 1 through 10. He looks at those and he says, those are sufficiently similar that I can develop a cap rate out of those. And they're similar because they're Section 42 properties, right?
Yes.
Okay. So if they are sufficiently similar to develop your cap rate, and I understand you can't reverse engineer from a cap rate to the restrictions.
Correct.
But you can go the other direction, right? You can say, well, here's the sales, and that feeds into my cap rate calculation. Would it be feasible? I understand the city didn't do it, but would it be feasible for the city to go to those same 10 properties, get the information on the limitations, and develop a sales comparison value?
I would say no.
Why?
The city assessors are not competent to do an analysis that would take the differences between those properties and make reliable adjustments between them.
Okay, just as a
unless they were identical.
Right. So let's say, just as a conceptual matter, let's say that they were competent to do that. Would it be appropriate as a methodological question to take those same 10 properties that Mr. McLaughlin used to develop the cap rate and then turn around and use those same 10 properties to develop the sales comparison value?
Yes, and Mr. McLaughlin testified that theoretically you could use a comparable sales approach if you had the underlying agreements and if the restrictions were similar enough to allow a comparison. But those are big ifs.
Right. Now, Mr. McLaughlin didn't know what the limitations were on those 10 properties he used to develop his cap rate. Right?
Doesn't make any difference. Different issue. The cap rate is merely looking at the mathematical relationship between income and sale price to determine a cap rate. So that's just looking at the market. So all you're looking at is all the properties in the relevant market to determine that relationship. That does not require knowledge of the specific restrictions. Different issue than the comparable sales analysis.
All right. So is it your position then that a cap rate based off of Section 42 properties would be different from a cap rate based off of Section 8 properties?
Yes, absolutely. No question about it.
Right. In developing the cap rate based on Section 42 properties, as you said, the limitations are important and they can vary from property to property. Why would Mr. McLaughlin not need to know the variation of limitations amongst those 10 properties to determine whether those are adequate sales to develop this cap rate?
Because, again, let me back up and try it a different way. Let's just assume we were just talking about normal general commercial properties. There are all tons of variations in value that affect normal general commercial properties. The cap rate is merely looking at the relationship between net income and sale price to determine that cap rate, which is also an indicator of what's the level of risk that what's the return on investment that investors are requiring. So by looking at sales of Section 42 properties, you get a range of cap rates that allows you to say, okay, this is fairly narrow range of cap rates that allows you to come up with, okay, this is sort of the average cap rate here as compared with, for example, what's the cap rate for market rate apartments. So the assessor's manual specifically says, for example, you cannot use a market cap rate when you're assessing subsidized housing because it's different.
Right,
the testimony is also with Section 8. Section 8 has a completely different market than Section 42. Section 8 properties are highly desirable, much lower risk. Again, you've got subsidized guaranteed rents. So the risk is lower, the cap rates are going to be lower.
And that's the key, is the measure of risk.
Yes.
So Section 8, Section 42, and market all have different risk rates.
Yes.
But are you saying then that Section 42 properties, the types of limitations that are applied to them are sufficiently similar that you don't need to know the distinction between them and that it's all going to have essentially the same risk?
For purposes of a cap rate, you don't need the underlying agreements because you're not doing a comparable sales analysis. You're just deriving a market-derived cap rate. So you're using the same analysis you would use in any other subset of the market.
And part of that is based on investors' risk tolerance.
Yes.
And the risk tolerance is going to be based in part on the kinds of limitations on each of those individual properties.
Yes. The risk reflects limitations, but that doesn't mean that you can compare the specific limitations applicable to each of the properties that go into your cap rate analysis. That's
so you're saying then that the band of risks for Section 42 properties is sufficiently narrow that you don't need to know what the limitations are on each of the individual properties that go into developing the cap rate, but they are so different from Section 8 properties that they can't be compared.
That's correct. And actually, the cap rate issue for the income approach for 2012 and 13 wasn't an issue of using a Section 8 cap rate versus a Section 42. It's that the assessors used a market rate apartment cap rate versus a Section 42. So they were treating this property as though there were no restrictions at all. And the assessor's manual specifically recognizes that you can't do that because the market for Section 42 properties is very different from the market for market rate apartments. And so the manual is explicit on that point, Ron.
Thank you very much, Counselor. Your red light's on.
I'm going to just say, when you come back, I'm going to ask you, one, is there a presumption in favor of the assessment, city assessment? Two, did you overcome that presumption? Three, if you did you put in sufficient evidence to support your view? And the answers in the courts have been against you. So, thank you. That's what I would like you to talk about.
May it please the court, Attorney Robert Hankel, appearing for the City of Racine. I think Justice Abramson touched on a couple of legal issues which I think at least have to be mentioned at the outset. One is the presumption of correctness that attaches to the assessor's assessment unless there's significant contrary evidence or some proof of failure to follow the law. And the other is the key law that applies to assessments in Wisconsin, what's known as the Markarian hierarchy, and a rule called the Bishop Rule, which says you don't use only income valuation without some other backup. Both of those, according to the issues I see outlined by the court, both of those streams of law would have to be overturned as applicable to Section 42 property in order for this appeal to be sustained. There's nothing in the manual, and by the way, the assessment manual does not trump statutory or case law, so we go to the statutory and case law over the manual in the event of a conflict.
No, but the manual is important.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and it's referred to in the statutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not like it's a loose cannon put out by somebody that they can then disregard.
No.
Say it's not based in law or fact.
No, absolutely.
Okay.
It's only in the situation where it would be a clear conflict if that were to exist.
Mr. Hankel, if we were to, well, clearly the first tier in Markarian does not exist. There's not a recent sale. So we drop down to tier two. If we were to conclude that there are insufficient comparable sales and that we therefore go to the income approach, would that be an appropriate application of Markarian, or would that be an overturning of Markarian?
It would be an appropriate application of Markarian in two instances. One, if the parties agreed, and there are cases cited by Regency West where that was the case. Both parties say, okay, we'll use the income approach. It also would be appropriate if the individual making that valuation or group making that valuation would buttress that with other evidence, as I think it's the, hope it's the Walgreen case, mentions that why don't you look at depreciation schedules, insurance, mortgage. There's a plethora of potential evidence out there to show, you know, what the value should be and to make sure that your income's not out of whack, because also, now I may be mixing up my cases, but it's probably Walgreen that did this, said you would have the absurdity of a business making no, having no income, and the property defaulting to zero, which is ridiculous. So, I mean, that would be the ultimate danger of just using the income approach.
Counselor, when you use the income approach, the factor that can change valuation the most is the cap rate that's applied. You divide the net operating income by the cap rate. So if you move the cap rate just a little bit, you get a huge difference in valuation. Opposing counsel says that the, quote, relevant market for determining the cap rate for this case is sales of Section 42 properties, and that you used as the relevant market the cap rate that would be determined by looking at the sales of ordinary rental property. Would you please address that?
Okay, I'm sorry, I've got a several part response to that. The cap rate is clearly important in ultimately determining what the value of the property is, but also important is the need to stabilize expenses so that you're not understating income, especially for a new property like this where you have no history. We've got evidence of the fact that Mr. McLaughlin used $27,000 for advertising when the actual expense was
$2,000. Okay, you are not answering my question. You're talking about is a good thing, and my colleagues may ask you, but if you don't answer me now, I won't get an answer.
Okay.
So I want to talk about the relevant market to determine the cap rate for this property.
In this case, the assessors of Racine were of the opinion that the cap rate they used was reflective of market rates, which was fairly reflective of Section 42 properties as well, because of the fact that rents were essentially equal, Section 8, Section 42, whatever. And we haven't had any discussion, the outside appraisers, Mr. Furtick and Mr. Weisenfluh, who did their own cap rate analysis, and one of the means of, they used three different methods of developing a cap rate, using market rates only to show a trend of cap rates going down as the economy was getting worse in terms of return on investment. But they also used band of investment and income stream analysis and came up with cap rates in the vicinity of 9%.
I'm sorry, I'm probably not asking the question well. I want to know, in order to determine the cap rate for this property, what is the relevant market from which you examine the sales and, of course, the income and expenses? I get that. But what is the relevant market? Is it just rental property? Is it Section 8? Is it Section 42? Is it a combination of all three? Is it one? I want to know the relevant market.
The relevant market will depend upon the economic conditions of the community and the area around. So the relevant market may be market rent, Section 42 and Section 8, without much distinction at all for cap rate, because the determination of the risk is, as in the case in Racine and the city of Milwaukee, there is no real vacancy risk. So because of that, that reduces the cap rate. And I would, if I could.
Okay, what is the relevant market that the assessor used that you believe we should say that was the relevant market? What did you use and why should we approve that?
The assessors in Racine, as I understand it, used the general market in the city of Racine for determination of cap rate. That's not true with respect to Mr. Furtick and Mr. Weisenfluh, who used the band of investment technique to develop a cap rate. But with respect to the cap rate, now that we're on that, I would also refer to Mr. McLaughlin's analysis. Actually, there were 15 sales he analyzed of Section 42 properties.
Okay, but the one we're asked to assume is correct is the assessor's use of the city of Racine globally as the relevant market. Am I understanding what you told me?
Yes, and you would only get to that if you don't accept the comp sales approach.
This court may never get to my question, but it's what bothers me. I just want to be sure I understand what you're telling me.
Yes, I told you that that's what they used for the income analysis that they did.
Super. Thank you so much.
Okay. But looking at Mr. McLaughlin's Exhibit 46, he used a cap rate of 10.5, which, as Chief Justice Rogensack just noted, is very instructive in determining what the value is going to be. The higher the cap rate, of course, the lower the value. Looking at his tax credit sales summary, the average is 7.5%. If he had added 2.5% to load that, he'd be 10%. That's a swing of a half a percent. That's already $100,000 that we've moved, over $100,000. And if you recognize that Racine, given these properties, is probably most similar to the Milwaukee area in terms of relative poverty. Racine has the highest unemployment rate in the state. So you go to a racially diverse community like Milwaukee is and like Racine is, and you look at the two properties there, item numbers 1 and 4, we have cap rates of 7.1 and 7%. I would argue, and I think correctly, that the correct loading of the cap rate, if Mr. McLaughlin had used this information, would have been a 9.5% load. Then, if we go to his failure to stabilize expenses, $25,000 in advertising, a failure to recognize 1.9% vacancy rate, instead using 4.9%, there's another swing of $43,000 in income. If you add that income to his $285,000 that he had, plus use a 9.5% cap rate, you have an increase in value of over $700,000. All this aside, if the court is to overturn, I believe it would have to overturn the Markarian hierarchy and the Bischoff rule as it applies to Section 42 property, we still get to Mr. McLaughlin's failure to conduct an appropriate analysis. He did not even use...
Before you get there, Mr. Henkel.
Yes.
The expenses that you referred for the analysis, were those based off of market properties, or were they based off of Section 42 properties?
Based off actual expenses of Regency West, which you're supposed to use according to Metropolitan. They're not made up numbers.
All right. So for 2012, when you use the income approach,
Yes, but again, I want to interject now. This is a certiorari appeal. That means we can go back with comp sales and look at what that property was worth by looking at comp sales. There was no challenge, unfortunately, in 2012, so there was no development of alternative theories, which happens, as assessors indicate, when there's a challenge. Janet Seid had 7,500 properties that she appraises. She can't do the whole ball of wax unless there's a challenge, and then it's done. But I'm sorry, no, I got off track on you. The expenses, the $27,000 of advertising is a year one expense. That's a startup cost. Anybody that's looking at stabilizing expenses will recognize that.
How did the city arrive at the stabilized expenses?
By looking at what is expected to be the case. And it's difficult to do. And in retrospect, you go back and you say we tried to stabilize the expenses. Turns out to be different. Advertising, that's a $25,000 swing because the actual expense, once startup costs were done, was $2,000. $25,000 in additional income. Also, the vacancy, non-existent on this property, which goes to risk as well as establishing a greater value, because now the vacancy allowance, which Mr. McLaughlin used, 4.9%, and incidentally, so did Mr. Furtick and Mr. Weisenfu, well, they used 3%, I'm sorry. The actual was 1.9%. That's a 60% difference on allowance of $30,000, another $18,000. But anyway, and that's just part of the shortcoming of the income approach, particularly on this new property. There's no history. You can't go back and look at 10 years of income flow and say that this is, you know, the way it would be. And in fact, when the first assessment was done, there was no history at all. And the second assessment, there's just 1 year, which includes all of the startup costs that I've referenced. Also, going again, I emphasize that we don't just have the city assessors. We have Mr. Weisenflu and Mr. Furtick, who did a comparable sales analysis, making adjustments. Two of their properties were Section 42 properties. Another one was in the process of being converted to Section 42.
Council, is there any evidence in the record that the city performed a statewide search for Section 42 comparable sales?
I don't recall that. I do know that Mr. McLaughlin did, but he didn't use it. But anyway, the cost approach, back up. The sales, comparable sales approach used by Mr. Furtick and Mr. Weisenflu did involve adjustments for age, condition, property uses. And in fact, in the case of the City Square property, there was a commercial component, which Mr. Furtick and Mr. Weisenflu valued and then subtracted it out. And by happenstance, there's a sale down the road, a couple years later or a year later, whatever it was, for a value that was almost identical to what they had calculated the value of that commercial property to be. Certainly an indication of the correctness of the valuation, comparable sale valuation performed by Mr. Furtick and Mr. Weisenflu.
Mr. Hankler, is it possible to do sufficient adjustments between Section 42 and Section 8 in market properties to derive an acceptable sales comparison value?
I believe so. I think that, you know, first of all, both Section 8 and Section 42 properties are rent controlled. There's just a certain amount of money you can make. They're both overseen. The federal government oversees both of them, so you're going to have to deal with the federal government as well.
There's a significant difference in risk, though, isn't there, between Section 8 and Section 42?
The risk that's involved here is twofold. One, you don't get payment, or two, you get vacancies. The vacancy risk is non-existent for Section 42. And the market, by the way, there is discussion of the market. The market for Section 42 properties is an emerging market. That's confirmed by testimony of Regency West witnesses as well as by the city witnesses. So there's a lot of data out there. But what you do is you look and see, how did this property sell compared to this property? What is the use? How much income is made? That's relevant. How much vacancy is? Are they reasonably equivalent so we can make adjustments? And certainly that should be something possible. But here we go to the credibility of the skill and experience and knowledge of the city assessors with their market, which Mr. McLaughlin conceded he did not know particularly well. And you go to Mr. Weisenflew and Mr. Furtick, who did use Section 42 properties and testified that as far as they could tell from the marketplace, the restrictions themselves did not appear to have an impact on the sales prices of these properties compared with each other. That is borne out by the fact that all these sales are occurring statewide now. As I think question implied, the cap rate does and should reflect what the restrictions are for given Section 42 properties.
Council, the manual indicates that for Section 42 properties, they comes with, I think, many restrictions. There's some kind of general phrase.
Yeah.
That phrase does not appear with regard to Section 8 properties. What are the differences in restrictions between the two?
I can't comment on that. I'm not sure what it would be, because it probably indeed is individual. However, the important thing here is what is the income that these properties are going to generate. And in the city of Racine, in fact, at Regency West, Section 8 tenants pay the same rent as Regency West tenants. The restrictions, whatever they may be, do not have an impact on what the income is, at least in the Racine market. And it also appears to be the case in the Milwaukee market, based upon the investigation that was performed by Mr. Weisenflew and Mr. Furtick.
Okay. There was a presumption that the Racine assessor is correct, right?
Correct.
What evidence rebuts that presumption?
Well, you show a valuation that would defeat what the presumption is, and the position that we take, and I think Wisconsin law supports, is you couldn't just present an income valuation. You would have to in some way back up what you arrived at that income valuation, and you certainly would have to stabilize your expenses. What was presented, forget about everything else, whatever was presented by Mr. McLaughlin is woefully insufficient to constitute significant contrary evidence because of his failure to do a USPAP compliance report, which is required by statute, which, unlike the case cited in Regency West brief, is not something that prevents it from being admitted, but it does go to the credibility of the methodology. He didn't stabilize expenses, and even a non-assessor like me, a non-appraiser, can see that $27,000 for advertising the first year is a startup cost. He didn't recognize the actual vacancy rate, and his other numbers are all over the place. One year it's 80,000, next year it's 40. There's no meat on those bones.
All right. The best of it, the first tier is comparable sales.
Second tier.
Okay, what's the first tier?
Sale of the property
of
itself.
But we don't have that.
Right.
So
no,
I mean
no,
that
no,
I eliminate
no.
that.
Okay.
So the second tier is comparable sales.
Yes.
And so the fight is going to be what is or isn't comparable, and by comparable doesn't mean exact.
Correct.
Right?
That's right.
So you can discount things when you're dealing with comparable. You have to have their arm's length. But once you have arm's length, the fact that they're not precise, that one has this restriction, the other has another, you can discount that. When I say discount, you can take that into account and knock it up or knock it down.
That's correct.
That is not comparable.
Yes,
sale,
and in fact, the Northland case, the one case that overturned an assessor's use of comp sales, was overturned for exactly the reason that Your Honor mentions. It was an arm's length. And by the way, it wasn't overturned with a finding of excessive tax. It was sent back to the Board of Review for further consideration.
Mr. Henkel, in developing the comparable sales for 2013 did the assessor have access to the information on limitations with respect to the properties that he used?
Other than the fact of knowing it was restricted, I don't know beyond that. I can't.
That what was restricted?
That the rents were, that there are restrictions on the rents, and that it's, you know, that there are consequences to that.
Well, they all know it was Section 42, didn't they?
Yes, they knew that.
There's no question about that.
There's no question that they knew that.
So, and everybody know, what they know is their restrictions, but is it clear from the record that they knew precisely what all the restrictions are?
I'm sure they did not know precisely all the restrictions. I should note also that one of the properties they used was a Section 42 property, and McMinn Towers, another one of the properties, was in attempts being made to convert it to Section 42.
Okay. After comparable sales, what's the next tier?
The next tier includes income. It includes cost, which, by the way, Mr. Weisenfluh and Mr. Furtick did do. They did a cost assessment, taking out the credits like they're required to do, and it, other indices of value, insurance, mortgage, depreciation schedules, whatever it may be.
So you don't have a recent sale. Question is whether you have comparable property, and that may be challenged. So you can also bring in evidence of the next tier. You say, well, you don't like that? I'm okay under the next year, right?
That's what we did through Mr. Weisenfluh and Mr. Furtick. Both, we did both income and cost.
Okay. So we've got that covered. You say we've got that covered under Racine. My understanding is that once there's a presumption, and even if the presumption is knocked out as a matter of law, the next step is, did the challenger produce sufficient evidence to support its assessment or to challenge your assessment? Is that the next step?
Yes, it's called burden of proof. They have the burden of proof no matter what.
That's right. I understand that. Of course, that's a real issue in this case because there's a question as to whether this burden of proof is a legal one, that is all a question of law, or are there questions of fact? And if they're fact, then we have to support the trial court and support the trier of fact, give it deference, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in this particular case, the trial judge found that the credibility of the expert witnesses fell with the four testifying for the city of Racine, and that includes their credibility in rendering the professional opinion that the Section 42 properties and Section 8 properties were appropriate for comparison. And again, that's only a couple of them. That's not the whole.
Credibility here isn't a question that they're lying. He's not finding out that they're lying. He's finding out that their testimony and their documentation is not persuasive. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
I'm sorry. The judge isn't saying that these appraisers are lying. He's saying that their testimony regarding how they reach their numbers and how they reach their result is not persuasive.
But the judge, as far as this, I'm not sure you're talking about the city assessors and city witnesses, the judge found to be more credible than the one Regency West witness who he found not to be credible. And, you know, he didn't understand the Markarian hierarchy. He didn't recognize
the
first.
Not the judge.
Mr. McLaughlin.
Right, the testifier.
He didn't recognize the first page of the assessment manual. He thinks that USAP doesn't apply, although there's a statute that says it applies to someone, an assessor making an assessment in the state of Wisconsin.
That's what he meant, that the testimony was defective under the law in his position, in being persuasive.
And the credibility of the witness. He did not find him to be credible compared to the four appraisers, assessors testifying for the
city. You want us to give deference to the trial court?
Well, of course I do. And, you know, and the Court of Appeals recognized that in its decision, finding that the credibility of witnesses was a factual finding that gave deference to the trial court. And as they mentioned, I should note that the statute 70.32, which codified the Markarian hierarchy, did make an exception, one exception for Section 42 properties, saying you can't value the tax credits. There's no evidence in this case that our witnesses in any way value the tax credits. And what's interesting is, this was in 1999, I believe, what's interesting is that when the legislature made that amendment and added that special rule for Section 42 properties, they did not say you can't use comparable sales, Markarian doesn't apply, forget the Bischoff rule with respect to this. Section 42 is on its own, and Mr. McLaughlin's business is going to boom because, as I think counsel stated, the witnesses for the city of Racine aren't competent to make this kind of evaluation.
If we were to conclude that the city's assessors used the improper methodology for arriving at a value, where do we go from there? Do we still affirm the Court of Appeals if we decide that Mr. McLaughlin's valuation didn't have sufficient indicia of reliability? Do we send it back for a new hearing? What's your position on that?
Well, first of all, I don't like the first part of your hypothetical, but getting past that, I take the position, and I think it's absolutely correct, that Mr. McLaughlin's testimony is insufficient to establish any kind of valuation in this circumstance. Whether the court then affirms the decision below or sends it back to the Board of Review, presumably, I guess that's a decision of the court, depending on how much. Defect you find in the whole record.
Okay.
Well, what defect in the whole record?
Pardon me?
What defect will we find? That's not what you're asking for.
No, I'm not. No. I'm just responding to the hypothetical.
Right,
I didn't like
it.
And then just stepping back a half a step, if I might, is it your position that in looking at comparable properties, the only thing that the assessor needs to do is note that they are Section 8 or Section 42 properties and apply a blanket adjustment to that, as opposed to knowing specifically what the limitations are on each of those properties?
I think that the adjustments that the assessor has to make, if he or she is looking at both Section 8 and Section 42 properties, again, I keep repeating myself, but Verdict and Weisenfluh weren't doing that, but anyway, looking at what Janet Seitz did, what she has to do is she has to make adjustments for location, size of the units, the relative income that's coming in, and in fact, I think that the rent in one of the properties, from memory, was less than Regency West. Regency West rental income per month was over almost $720 per unit, according to their income numbers, which was testified uncontrovertibly is almost equal to market rate in the city of Racine. City of Racine is not a wealthy community. And, the sad thing is that if the court accepts that Section 42 properties get their own special breaks with assessment law, the people that will pay for that will be the residents of the city of Racine.
Yeah. I just want to make sure that I understand your answer to my question. So are you saying that there is no adjustment that needs to be made when you're dealing with, say, a Section 8 property as comparable to a Section 42 property?
I think that depends in part on the economic condition of the community that you're looking at, and there is an adjustment necessary if there is a clear difference in rents being obtained. That would be reflective of rent control that is adversely affecting one or the other groups.
Okay, so we can bypass entirely what limitations there might be on a property. We can just look at the rent that they're able to charge.
Rent should be reflective of the limitations.
According to the brief of the petitioner, the position taken is, one, they've overcome the presumption, okay? But even if they've overcome the presumption, they have to fit the next step, which is they've got to produce evidence that says the assessment should be Y.
Yes, they have to prove that.
That's right. And if they fail at that level, they lose. Do you get a second kick at the cat?
Well, I'm sure we'll see that, but if that's the basis of them losing. I can't predict what Regency West will or will not do, but presumably they would then have the right, depending on what this court's decision is, to come back the next year.
For the next year. I'm talking about the 2 years at issue here. If they can't have sufficient proof at the hearing that the assessment should be the number they want, which is roughly $2.7 million, give or take, right?
Yes.
If they failed to prove that, and the trial courts that they failed to prove that, then they lose for 2012-2013. You can always come back for next year.
Yes, that's correct.
All right.
They lose because they had their day in court.
They have their day in court. Yes, they don't get a second kick at
yes,
the assessment.
Yes, just like a defendant going not guilty, even though there might be evidence out there to prove him. It's double jeopardy. It's not fair comparison, but it's the same kind of thing.
Thank you very much, Counselor.
Okay.
I am most interested in the cap rate, and I have this question for you. In the cap rate your expert used, he used as the relevant market Section 42 housing. But he added to what he determined from that market, I think about 2%.
Yes.
Okay. Was it for taxes?
Yes.
Okay.
That's required in the manual.
Okay. Well, it may or may not be required. And let me just tell you what my problem is. All of the Section 42 houses would have some kind of a tax rate attached to them. And why isn't that reflected in the sales? Because if you're going to do a cap rate based on 42 housing, you are taking into account what a willing buyer will pay for that property and what kind of return they expect to incur that risk, correct?
Yeah.
So I don't know why you added the extra back in. And you call it the loaded cap rate. I read the manual. I read it again as I sat here. I know what it says.
Right.
But I'm putting it together with your expert's opinion, and I don't see why you add in that extra
right.
2%.
Actually, the assessors did the same thing, Your Honor, and the reason is that for property tax purposes, when you're trying to determine what the appropriate property tax is, the appraiser or the assessor takes out the property taxes out of the expenses because that's the variable you're trying
to
determine.
You could take it out of the expenses, but that doesn't take it out of the cap rate. It
right.
takes it out of the NOI.
Right.
Okay.
So the cap rates have it in there, but the NOI takes it out, and so for purposes of adjusting the NOI, they put it into the cap rate.
But it doesn't adjust the NOI, because if
no.
you adjusted the NOI by 2%, you're going to get a very different valuation than if you adjust the cap rate.
It
by
actually
2%.
Mathematically comes out the same, but. But with all due respect, it's not an issue because they both did it.
It's an issue for me because we'd like to give people directions in the future about what's the way to go.
Yeah.
And mathematically, I don't think it works out the same. But that's just our seeing that factual issue differently.
Just to address some of the other questions that came up. First, standard of review is de novo under Adams and Allwright. There is no deference given to the trial court. The Suline case, I think, is particularly instructive on this, where the court says, this isn't a typical case of witness credibility where it depends on what somebody observed and you're looking at demeanor. The issue is whether or not the witnesses appropriately applied a valuation formula, and the trial court is in no better position to determine that than this court, and the appellate court, in fact, may be in a better position because it has better resources.
The standard of review might be de novo, but the assessment is entitled to a presumption of correctness.
It is, and the presumption is overcome under this court's opinion in Adams under either of two circumstances, and we have satisfied both of them. First, we've presented significant contrary evidence. Second, we have presented overwhelming evidence of violations of the assessor's violations of the manual and law.
Let's go with the second item there. If we were to conclude that is in fact the case, and the presumption goes away, then what? Do we simply accept Mr. McLaughlin's valuation? Do we send it back for a new hearing? What do we do?
We believe that we have satisfied the burden of persuasion through the testimony of and report of McLaughlin. If you look at the trial court's rejection of McLaughlin, it was based on two legal errors. First, the court said McLaughlin didn't follow Markarian because he didn't use comp sales and he relied solely on an income approach. We've explained why it was appropriate not to rely on the comp sales. This court has explicitly said it's appropriate to rely solely on the income approach. That was the Adams case. The manual also says it's appropriate to rely on one approach.
Right. So we make sure we get this in. If we were to conclude that the city's assessment is incorrect because of methodology, that doesn't automatically mean that Mr. McLaughlin is right. What if we decide to pox on both their houses? They're both wrong. What do we do then?
If that were the case, I think there would have to be a new trial. We are not asking for a new trial. We are asserting that we have met the burden of proof. There is nothing wrong with McLaughlin's analysis. He completely followed to a T the legal requirements. He used the expenses specific to the property, and I want to go back to that because that's an error in the assessment and the income assessment of the assessors that we haven't talked about. They not only used the wrong cap rate, but they used a market expense ratio rather than expenses specific to the property. Clear violation of the manual, clear violation of Metropolitan Holding that alone requires reversal.
Right. So isn't there a requirement that stabilized expenses be used?
No. What Mr. Hankel is confused about is the concept of a retrospective appraisal. What we're talking about here is an appraisal for 2012 and 13 that was done years later. What his outside appraisers tried to do was use subsequent year expense information and back it up and treat it as though a buyer in January 2012 or January 2013 would have known what subsequent year expenses were. That has no place here.
Why not? Let me just phrase this for you. When we talk about assessment, we talk about fair market value. When we talk about fair market value, we talk about what would an informed buyer do. But that's a bit of a construct, right? Just a bit of a construct. What we're trying to accomplish here is figure out what the tax ought to be on this property. Why shouldn't we be able to use actual knowledge of what the expenses actually were, as opposed to putting ourselves in the position of the buyer at that time speculating about what the expenses might be?
Because of the definition of fair market value, Your Honor. The definition of fair market value is looking at the valuation date, which in this case is as of January 1/12, as of January 1/13. What would a willing buyer pay as of that date with the knowledge as of that time? Undisputed that what a buyer as of January 12 would look at is what's the income and expenses known of that date. January 1/13, that what was the income and expenses known of that date. We didn't have a year's worth of income and expenses in the prior year, we had projections from four different sources that were completely reliable and consistent. That's what a buyer would look at. And in 13, we had audited financials for the year ending December 31 of 2012 that the assessor simply disregarded and instead used a market expense ratio in direct violation of the manual and the Metropolitan Holding case.
Thank you.
So in summary, we are asking for reversal and a new trial, and we are not asking for a new trial. We're asking for judgment in our client's favor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for interesting arguments. This is the kind of law that I always find really a mind tease because there are very many pieces and parts that go into it. So I thank you very much. I thank you for helpful brief. We are going to take a recess until we begin our third case of the day, which is at 1:30.